My next talk is by Dan Reed from the University of California, Santa Barbara. Dan is a PI at the Santa Barbara Channel LTER site, and we'll be talking about social ecological interactions in coastal marine systems.
Okay, the purpose of my talk this morning is to show how a research framework that integrates social and ecological sciences is very relevant to coastal marine ecosystems. And there's probably no place on Earth more appropriate for studying the interactions between humans and the environment than the coastal zone, which is arguably the most densely populated and heavily utilized region in the world. The LTR network has diversified considerably into the marine realm, with 8 of the 26 sites having a direct link to the coastal ocean. And this includes pelagic ecosystems in temperate and polar waters represented by the California Current and Palmer Station LTRs, temperate and tropical reef ecosystems represented by the Santa Barbara Coastal and more Morea Coral Reef LTRs, and estuarine and marine embayments that harbor barrier islands, salt marsh habitat, soft bottom habitat, and mangroves, which are represented by the Virginia Coast, Georgia Coast, Plum Island, and Florida Everglades LTRs. Well, this is a conceptual framework that you're probably familiar with by now. And in relating how this applies to coastal marine ecosystems, I'd like to first start by focusing on the environmental drivers of ecosystem change. And in particular, I want to pay special attention to this double-headed arrow here, which indicates how different types of drivers interact with one another to influence the structure and function of natural communities. Well, there's a whole wide range of environmental drivers that influence coastal marine ecosystems. I've shown some of these on this diagram here, and I've categorized them into three main groups. The drivers in the climate box are largely natural in origin, whereas those in the land use and extraction box are influenced primarily or entirely by human activities. And all the different arrows you see represent the ways different types of drivers interact with one another to influence different types of ecosystem processes. We often talk about drivers as being either pulse or press, and in reality, many of them actually occur along a continuum in space and time. And whether they act in a short-term pulse or long-term press manner really depends on the organisms that are studied and the response variables that are measured. I'd like to just show you a little example of this using drivers that affect nutrient delivery to coastal marine ecosystems. Now, internal waves are a local tidally driven process that what they ultimately do is they take a cold, nutrient-rich water from depth offshore and move it into inshore and shallower waters. Wind-driven upwelling accomplishes much the same thing, but using a very different mechanism that is very seasonal in its occurrence and occurs typically over larger spatial scales. Now, nutrients are also delivered to the coast from land via runoff. Runoff can be in short pulses, or they can also occur rather continuously. And this is going to vary with time of year and location and such. And these kinds of drivers are embedded then in a larger climatic regime, which fluctuate oftentimes between nutrient-rich conditions and nutrient-poor conditions. And those fluctuations can occur depending on the type of climatic regime on order of a couple of years, which is the case of El Niños, to decades, which occur in these longer climatic oscillations, all the way up to millennia, which occur during kind of more global climate change processes. And so consequently, the importance of drivers that occur at relatively small or short-term temporal and spatial scales are really dependent on the status of drivers that occur at larger spatial scales and temporal scales. And so for instance, the importance of internal waves in delivering nutrients to a reef ecosystem is really dependent on whether or not they occur during an upwelling season or a non-upwelling season. Likewise, the importance of upwelling really varies between El Nino and non-El Nino years. And the frequency and severity of El Ninos typically is influenced by larger scale climatic regimes. Okay, so what we want to do is start to look at how the interaction of these environmental drivers influence the structure and function of the kelp forest, okay? And so as we move around this framework here, what I'd like to do is focus on giant kelp forests is an ecosystem, which is the focal ecosystem of the Santa Barbara LTR. Now, one could easily do this exercise using any of the coastal marine biomes represented by the LTR. And the major thing that would change are just the details of the examples. I also want to focus on how these the interaction between structure and function actually feed back to influence each other. Okay. Well, giant kelp forests are cosmopolitan in their distribution. They occur on shallow reefs and cool temperate seas on the western coast of North and South America, southern coast of Australia, South Africa, and in the sub-Antarctic Isles, including New Zealand. They've long been admired for their natural beauty, which is exemplified by relatively high diversity and trophic complexity. The foundation species in this system is giant kelp, and by that I mean many other species are dependent upon it, which is something that Darwin recognized nearly 150 years ago. Giant kelp provides food and shelter for a wide variety of organisms, ranging from these small, colorful little snails in the center there, which live on the forest floor, to migrating gray whales that come into the forest during their migration to feed on small little shrimp that live on the kelp. Well, in addition to the diverse biotic structure in kelp forests, they also have relatively high functional value. They're very productive ecosystems. The graph on the left here shows that the measurements that we have for giant kelp alone rival those of some of the most productive tropical rainforests in the world, and are considerably higher, on order of 3 to 10 times higher than estimates for other biomes represented by the LTR network. Now, another important function that ecosystem serves is their ability to recycle nutrients. And high production in kelp forests really is derived from a relatively small amount of biomass that turns over on average about 7 times per year, which is, again, quite high relative to some of the other ecosystems. And there's very little carbon storage in this system, and instead kelp detritus is rapidly broken down and recycled. Well, environmental drivers are very important in causing the structure of these systems to change. And kelp forests frequently alternate between two primary states. One is a very lush forested state that has a very complex trophic structure, and the other is a relatively barren deforested state, which tends to be dominated by invertebrate grazers or suspension feeders. And the way you get shifts from one state to the other is by changes in the environmental drivers. For instance, changes in predators, drivers that cause predators to decline, such as things like fishing, for instance, can have influences on the herbivores that graze the system. It can lead to an increase in the herbivores. Herbivore densities can also change as a result of large disturbances, or I'm sorry, the forest can also change as a result of large disturbances that remove the vegetation, increasing the competition among the herbivores that are there, which tends to have a negative feedback on the forest and further suppresses the vegetation in the forest. We also get sort of climatic changes that influence the conditions that are favorable for kelp growth. In this case, warm, nutrient-poor conditions, such as those that occur during El Niños, can greatly reduce the biomass in the forest, increase the competition among herbivores for that resource, and again, drive the forest to a more deforested state. Conversely, drivers that increase predator say, such as things like conservation, human activities that actually try to preserve predator densities, can lead to herbivore declines. The same kinds of physical disturbances that remove vegetation can also remove herbivores during a relatively barren state. Or you can get conditions that are very favorable for kelp growth, so that even without changes in herbivore density, you can get the algae in the system overwhelming the herbivores, which causes a change in their behavior from a very active grazing mode where they feed on live plant material to one, a very passive feeding mode where they feed on detrital material. And that has positive feedbacks in the system, which then promote the growth of algae in the system and maintain it in a forested state. Okay, well, shown in this graph here, then, is the fraction of reefs in Southern California that are in the Florida state for about a 40-year time period here. And as you can see, this is a very dynamic system. You know, there's this highly variable changes in the fraction of reefs that are forested. And a lot of this variability is driven by climatic conditions. What we see is that during El Nino years, when conditions are very unfavorable for kelp growth, we see a much smaller fraction of the reefs that are forested. Now, El Ninos are not all the same, in fact, and what we find is that El Ninos during the cool phase of the Pacific decadal oscillation tend to be less frequent and less severe than those that occur during the warm phase. So what we see is that the greatest fraction of reefs that are in a deforested condition occur during the warm phase, during El Ninos that occur during the warm phase of the Pacific decadal oscillation. Well, kelp isn't the only thing that's influenced by environmental change. Other components in the system are as well. These are data collected by researchers at Santa Barbara on fish assemblages in the Santa Barbara Channel. And what they found that during the mid-1970s, when the PDO cycle was in a cool phase, that the reef assemblage of fishes was dominated by northern cold water species. As the climate changed, that assemblage changed as well to one that had a higher proportion of more southern warm water species. Well, in addition to the structure of the community, environmental drivers can directly influence the function of the community as well. And what I've plotted here is year-to-year variation in net primary production. So small values in this graph indicate that production varies very little from year to year. Large values indicate large, high variability from year to year. And what we see is that not only is the mean value of net primary production in kelp forests higher than most systems, we also find that they're much more variable. And a lot of that variability is due to environmental drivers that that cause changes in the structure of the system. And remember that structure and function are intimately linked, and feedback occurs between the two. And so what we find is that, like most other systems, that the production, the net primary production in the system is directly linked to the amount of biomass of the vegetation. So changes in environmental drivers that change the structure of the system, in this case the biomass of kelp, have a profound influence on the function of the system, in this case primary production. Well, there are other functions of the system that are influenced by the structure as well, and one of those is the ability to transfer energy into higher trophic levels. And we have evidence from stable isotope analyses that indicate that giant kelp provides a major source of dietary carbon for a diverse group of consumers in the kelp forest food web. The colored boxes that you see in this diagram here represent the carbon and nitrogen stable isotope signatures of the main sources of primary production available to the consumers in the forest. The blue squares that you see represent different species of organisms that feed directly on the bottom. The red circles represent different species of organisms that actually feed on particulate matter suspended in the water column. And the take-home message here is that those blue squares kind of cluster out above the kelp box, indicating that kelp is an important component in some form to the diet of this diverse group of bottom feeders. And I should mention that these are not just species that feed directly on the kelp, but they also include predators, detritivores, and scavengers as well. Okay. Well, it turns out that a relatively small fraction of the production in the forest is actually consumed in the forest, and the vast majority of it is exported out of the forest during large storm events. And much of that ends up on the beach, where it serves as primary prey for these small little crab-like things, amphipods, which in turn form a major prey item for many different species of shorebird, such as this black-bellied plover. And so what researchers at Santa Barbara have found is that beaches that tend to have high accumulation of dripped kelp on the beach tend to have high abundances of amphipods and shorebirds as well. Okay, well, as we move around the cycle here, we note that the structure and function of the community really determine the types and amounts of services that the ecosystem provides. well, in the case of KelForce, there's a variety of different kinds of ecosystem services. They can be classified into these different groups. Provisioning services include things like fisheries and aquaculture and the various pharmaceuticals they get from different species in the kelp forest. And kelp itself, because of its really rapid growth rates, has been considered a potential biofuel. A lot of research was done in the 1970s and 80s on this, actually. Cultural services include things like education. Kelp forests are prime exhibit in many marine aquaria. They tend to be a very common feature in a lot of educational outreach programs. Recreational activities in kelp forests include things like scuba diving and recreational fishing. They're prized for their aesthetic value, and all these kinds of things actually influence tourism, which is another important ecosystem service. In terms of regulating service, I mentioned some a bit about the ability of, or the importance of kelp forests in conserving biodiversity. They also function much like wetlands do in the sense that they influence water quality by their capacity to filter out a lot of suspended and particulate materials in the water column. They form a dense canopy at the surface of the ocean. That canopy has a very modifying influence on the sea surface. It largely cuts out wind chop, which is a very attractive feature to swimmers and surfers who tend to congregate in areas inshore of kelp forests. So there's a variety of ecosystem services. And what I'd like to do is take an example of one of those services and show how it's influenced by changes in the structure of the forest. And this here is a red sea urchin. And red sea urchins form the second largest commercial fishery in California. They're fished for their roe, which are their gonads. And their gonads are largely, it's a delicacy. It's a caviar type thing. And they're largely dependent on the size and quality of the gonads, largely dependent on the food that the urchins eat. And the primary food item of urchins is giant kelp. And so what I plotted in this graph here is the abundance of giant kelp and the abundance of the sea urchin catch over time for the duration of the fishery. This is a relatively new fishery, started in the 1970s. And what you see is that a rapid declines in the catch of red sea urchins is correlated to rapid chain declines in the abundance of giant kelp, which coincides during El Nino years. So we have environmental drivers driving the structure of the system, which is then driving the ecosystem services that the system provides. Okay, resource planners, economists, policymakers and the like, they're interested in the extent to which ecosystem services influence the quality of life that people have and the choices that people make and the extent to which human behavior and human outcomes interact to influence each other. Well, the example I gave in the ecosystem service was a commercial fishery. And it turns out commercial fisheries actually constitute a relatively small fraction of the coastal economy in California. In contrast, tourism and recreation account for upwards of almost 60% of the coastal economy. Now, things like education, conservation, aesthetics, and the like, they don't factor into these kinds of analyses, but are no less important in the minds of many people. Well, it turns out, you probably know, different types of ecosystem services are frequently at odds with each other. And typically, many cultural services and regulating services are in direct competition with provisioning services. Things like conservation and aesthetics, you know, simply are not compatible with activities such as commercial fishing and oil and gas development. Okay, and this is certainly the case when it comes to kelp forests. One of the key predators historically in kelp forests has been the southern sea otter, which has been considered a keystone species because of its ability to have a very strong influence on the structure and function of kelp forest communities. Sea otters are eat primarily shellfish. They have a very voracious appetite. They eat upwards of 25% of their body weight per day. Okay, and turns out because of their ability to to basically keep herbivore grazers in check, populations of grazers in check, we find that the fraction of kelp forests that are in the sort of deforested state is typically relatively rare in the presence of sea otters. Now, sea otters have a very large fan base. They're these adorable little creatures. Conservationists and tourists alike, you know, flock to see sea otters. But they're typically despised by fishermen. And it turns out that shell fisheries and shell fishermen simply can't coexist in the presence of a viable sea otter population. Well, sea otters were hunted to near extinction in the 1970s and 80s, or in the 1700s and 1800s for their fur. And in 1914, fur hunting was banned. And since that time, the small relic population of sea otters in California has expanded greatly, upwards from about a dozen or so animals to now over 2,500 or so. And what we've seen a few blips in that recovery, and those blips have been corrected by regulatory actions that have limited certain types of fishing activities that have resulted in a bycatch of otters and stuff. And so what we see is that the cultural and regulating services provided by sea otters has really come at the expense of provisioning services provided by fisheries. Well, in completing the framework here, you know, we recognize that society frequently implements legislation or policies that are aimed at minimizing the human drivers of ecosystem change with the intent of conserving or even maximizing the services that ecosystems provide. And when you have different types of services that are in conflict with each other, this often results in controversial legislation. And controversial legislation is very common in California. And these are some of the more controversial legislative acts that have occurred over the last several years or so. And I'm not going to go too much into the details of these. I can talk to you about them later. But the fact of the matter is that there's been a lot of controversy on them. The last one down here, the implementation of the Marine Life Protection Act, that's something that has just occurred in the last few years or so. And what I'd like to do is talk about this one a little. What the intent here was because of concern over dwindling fisheries and the lack of biotic diversity, that there is a big move to implement a marine reserve network in California, which has been very controversial and largely opposed by many of the commercial and recreational fishermen. This graph here, what I've done is I've plotted the index, the monthly values for the Pacific Decadal Oscillation Index. And what it shows is since 1900, it's fluctuated between warm and cool and warm phases. And there's speculation among climatologists and oceanographers that we're beginning to enter into a cool phase, okay? And that started around the year 2000 or so, which is the same year the Marine Life Protection Act was enacted, and shortly after the Santa Barbara Channel Islands Marine Reserve was established. So when we look at a species trajectory, a population trajectory for a species like the black surf perch, which is a very common reef fish in kelp forests in California, we see that in the 1980s and the later part of the last century, rapid declines in the populations of these species. The Channel Islands Marine Reserve is established, and boom, the population starts increasing again. So the question really becomes, is this due to changes in fishing effort, you know, or do these changes really reflect climatic changes from a relatively unfavorable, unproductive climate to one that is more productive? Okay? And these are very challenging questions, but they're questions that we need to know in order to evaluate whether or not the legislation we're enacting is really effective in doing what we want it to do. And this is precisely what researchers at the California Current LTR have been doing. They've made use of a 50-year data set on larval abundance of 29 species of fish, and these species included both fish species and unfished species. And in the fisheries world, larval abundance is a pretty good predictor of population size of fish, okay? And so this graph here is from a recent publication that they have in Nature, and the bottom line of this graph is that the red circles in this graph tend to be higher than the blue triangles. And the take-home message of this is that year-to-year variation in larval abundance, which again is a predictor of population size, which is plotted on the y-axis here, that fish species are much more variable than unfished species, even when you count for differences in life history such as age and maturity. And this is the kind of information we really need to have in order to evaluate effective management. Okay, so where does the LTR come into this? Well, long-term data provided by networks such as the LTR are really needed to understand not only the patterns but the causes for variation or changes in ecosystems. And that this knowledge is really essential for evaluating the effectiveness of the policies that we enact that alter, designed to alter human behaviors that influence the structure and function of ecosystems and the services that they provide to humans.
We have time for just one question.
When you talk about the difficulty of incorporating aesthetics into your assessment of ecosystem services, those of us who are old remember the oil spill in Santa Barbara in the late 60s.
I remember it. I'm not that old.
But in any case, that was a huge motivator. I mean, there were huge changes in the way oil tankers and then the beaches and offshore drilling. I guess one of the great challenges in this feedback between ecosystem services and human behaviors, how do we account for extreme events like that obviously motivate policy change and human perceptions and a whole bunch of things? Are there efforts to add that element of ecosystem services to that necessary work?
I guess the question is, are there efforts? I'm not sure. Should there be efforts? Clearly we need to be incorporating those things. The diagram that I showed there was really a diagram I pulled out of a report to kind of evaluate the different kinds of services. It's an economic analysis. It doesn't include those kinds of things. But clearly, aesthetics is a reason why tourists go to a certain area, right? And so, I'm not answering your question.
Yeah, I'm kind of highlighting it. It's just one of the exciting areas of ecosystem services. I mean, we use things that we can put numbers on. Mm-hmm. Things that we can put numbers on, such as dollars, might not be the biggest drivers of human behavior change. Mm-hmm.
Thanks,
Dan.
Well, it kills me to suppress questions, but I'll ask the speakers to stick around for a bit after we finish so that you'll be able to ask them personally.